this week's episode of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. This week, we kick things off with a new segment featuring myself, Zach, and Andy. Following that, I leave and Zach and Andy talk about Cave Story 3D. Next, Danny Bivens joins me to discuss his recent feature about the expansion ports on the variety of Nintendo home consoles. Lastly, Pedro, Neil, and I discuss Kirby's Return to Dream Land. Enjoy.
All right, well, I'm Zach Miller here with Scott Thompson.
Hello.
And Andy Gergen.
What's going on, y'all?
And we have news. And when I say news, I mean one news story.
I think technically it's called new.
I was going to say, new, is that yeah. new?
I think the singular of news is new.
It's but it's the one exciting piece of news that's come out this week. It's not even really exciting. It's more depressing, really.
It's exciting if you have an infinity amount of money.
Yeah. But we're actually not going to talk about the news right away because it kind of – the news segment kind of comes from this letter that we got. And so we got a piece of listener mail, and we've chopped it down a bit. Who's this from?
Yeah, actually, I was going to say, I didn't put that in there.
It's from Zach.
I think not you.
I swear I didn't write this, but it is from Zach with a K.
Let's call him Zach too.
Well, the inferior spelling of Zach.
Ouch.
Zach writes, "What is up with the new pricing for 3DS games? Mind you, I am not complaining about it because the price point of Frogger got me to get it, and I was happy, and I did the same with Tetris." He must mean they cost $35 or $30.
Yeah, I think Frogger was $30. And I would say $30 is the high end of what I would say Frogger is worth.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, price point for 3DS games, it's always been too high. Day one.
Yeah, $40 for a handheld game is a bit much, especially when, for the most part, they've just been re-releases of N64 games.
You know, I'm kind of curious about something. We say that $40 is too much for a handheld game, and I think it's pretty much considered to be a general agreement that that's the case. I mean, we're living in an ecosystem where iPhone games cost, you know, one to $5 generally. I kind of wonder if the problem is not that these handheld games cost too much. Rather than, I wonder if the problem is actually they're making the wrong kinds of games for handheld systems. Like, I mean, I'm very excited about playing Resident Evil Revelations, but truth be told, I'd rather just play it on my TV. And if it was on the TV, no one would complain about a $40 price point. Everyone would be perfectly happy for it.
Really happy for it. That'd be cheap.
I think this is one of the things that I think has been a misstep for Nintendo is that they may have had so much success marketing the DS as a platform to play, you know, mobile game experiences. I mean, I think Picross 3D is the ultimate in that. It's a very, very much a pick-up-and-play game. You can always close the lid. You don't feel like you're missing anything. I mean, they've had games like Pokemon, and don't get me wrong, they've had big game experiences, but Revelations is a whole other ball of wax. It's a high-end, like, uber-detailed Resident Evil 5, basically. I mean,
yeah.
I was talking to former staffer Grant Buell today on Instant Messenger, and he made the comment that for $50, they may as well call this Resident Evil 6.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much, which I guess if no one's heard the news yet, yeah, it was just announced that Resident Evil Revelation, I know it jumped the gun a little bit, but
yeah,
that's okay, it's going to cost $50. And what was our explanation? There's an extra chip, like, in the
Yeah, it's some special
the
chip
it's a four
that giga- they're making.
It's a 4 gigabyte cartridge. I'm not sure what the regular size is, but apparently it's a larger cartridge because it's got a whole bunch of really detailed textures.
I think the normal cartridge is 2 gigs, if I'm not mistaken.
That's probably likely, yeah.
Well, they did the same thing with, you know, Super Nintendo when they bulked up a cartridge's, memory space. They raised the price quite a bit.
They say that the game has 20 hours of gameplay. That's probably a generous estimate because most Resident Evil games don't generally run that long, but I mean, I think RE4 was probably about a
20-hour game. I'd say
15 to 20-hour game. Okay.
Yeah, when you get everything.
And I mean, no one complained about paying $50 for RE4, and no one really seemed to complain paying $50 for RE5 or $60 for RE5. I mean, no more than the usual.
Yeah.
So there's the problem that Resident Evil 5 or Resident Evil Revelations shouldn't cost $40 or $50, or is the argument that no mobile game should cost $40, $50? And I think the answer to that is this game shouldn't be on a mobile platform. This is not the kind of game that should be on a mobile platform, 3D or not.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it kind of brings up another interesting point. I think, Zach, you just said that, you know, before they would charge extra for Super Nintendo games that maybe had the FX chip or were, bigger cartridges. But, I mean, you don't see that nowadays. I mean, when Final Fantasy 13 came out and it was like two or three discs or whatever, they don't charge you extra per disc. You know, I mean, the 360, a lot of games now come on at least two discs because they can't fit it all in a standard DVD.
Part of that
they don't charge you an extra $15 or $10 because it's on two CDs, you know?
Part of that's because discs are really cheap. I mean, that's the reason these things are on discs nowadays is because discs are infinitely cheaper than putting out physical cartridge media. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm really excited about this game. I think another piece of the same bit of news is that it's going...
Dude, it's why I bought a 3DS.
It's going to have online co-op. I mean, shit, I'm so excited for that. I never played RE5 because the people that I would have played RE5 with at the time it came out didn't have a 360. Or didn't have a PS3, or I didn't know them when the game came out. When did that game come out? 07?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I wasn't on staff until 09, I think. So, I mean, I didn't know that many other gamers at the time that I would have played online with. So, I mean, I never played RE5 co-op. I played a little bit with Nathan Mustafa over Games for Windows Live, which, by the way, was a laughably frustrating experience.
I'm not surprised.
Because we bought it on Steam, and then Steam launched the Games for Windows client. So we had to like disable our voice chat settings on Steam so that we could enable our voice chat settings on Games for Windows or vice versa. We had to be connected through two different DRMs at once to play that game online. It was a goddamn mess. And on top of that, I don't have any way of putting my 360 controller on my PC. So I was trying to play Resident Evil with a mouse and keyboard, and it was just about enough. I was done in 5 minutes. I couldn't tolerate it.
That's probably like playing old school Resident Evil. Like the tank controls almost, like just moving back and forth.
I would take that over mouse and keyboard on that kind of game in a heartbeat, personally. I'm really excited about Revelations. I mean, and they said it's going to support the second circle pad, but it's not going to be bundled in for that $50 price point. And that's another big thing. I mean, I don't know if you guys going to be picking up the circle pad add-on?
Maybe.
Yeah, it's all going to depend for me. It's not something I'm just going to go out and get, but if the right game comes along that supports it and is made better with it, probably.
I think if they bundled in the circle pad, I could totally see the $50 price point, just because whenever you're bundling hardware with software, you're going to see the price increase. But now it sounds like if they were going to do that, they'd have to bump it up to like $60 probably.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Oh, man.
And that's never going to fly. I have a feeling they've already torpedoed their chances of this game selling. I just don't see it happening. I mean,
it has to be incredible. You know, like I even for me to spend $50 on it, I feel like it has to review incredibly well for me to get it. I mean, if it's even sort of middle of the road, I just can't justify $50 for a handheld game.
I expect the game to be very good.
I'm just glad I'm getting the review copy.
Well, you can let me know then.
I will.
I think this is a good opportunity to ask for two review copies so we can play online co-op.
Oh, that's right. There's going to be online co-op, which probably won't work given how online games have been working so far.
Right. But yeah, I mean, we started this segment talking about the $40 price point, and even that, like, I'm not super okay with. So $50 is just sort of a leap there, unless it's really good.
I mean, let's be real here. You're talking to a guy right now and me who I don't buy games for full price. Buy one or two games a year at full price, and when I do, it's a surprise to me that I managed to come up with the money to do so.
Yeah.
Like, I would love to go buy Arkham City right now, but I don't got $60 to spend. Same with Uncharted 3. When Mario comes out, I'm going to try to get it, but honestly, it seems kind of unlikely.
Mario's going to have to be a birthday present for me.
I'm broke. I can't just go drop $50 right now. If I could, I'd probably have cable. I don't even got cable right now.
Yeah, there's a lot coming out right now. Yeah, it's very complicated time. When does Resident Evil actually come out?
Something February. Like February, I think. Yeah.
Yep. That's at least a little better. At least it's after the holiday season there.
I'd almost rather it came out in the holiday season so I could at least ask for it for Christmas or something.
That's true. Ask for it for Valentine's Day. Does that work?
Nothing says I love you like Resident Evil Revelations.
Or do you still get an Easter basket like with candy and stuff? Because you could go that route too.
Yeah.
Every now and then we could trick my mom and for Easter and like to getting us like a game or something in our Easter basket and then just a little bit of candy instead of just a shit ton of candy.
I think when I was in high school, I asked for I got an Easter gift occasionally, and then one year I actually asked for one and was. I got the thing that I asked for, but I was thoroughly reminded that's not what Easter is for.
Whatever, man.
I think it was like a CD, but I couldn't even tell you which CD it was.
Like, I know one year I got like one of the whatever Pokemon was out at the time, and then my brother got the opposite color, and like it was just the greatest Easter of all time.
So assuming that Revelations is a game that could theoretically be called RE6, like it's that good. Like it is, like, it is the next great RE game. And assuming the online co-op works without any hitches, and assuming that it doesn't have any weird control hang-ups, like, assuming you can play the game with or without the circle pad, and it works really well, and the game is getting, like, 9s, 9.5s, you think $50 well spent?
Yeah. I do, especially if you like Resident Evil.
I do. I really do.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I really like Resident Evil, too. And, I mean, I was pretty high on this game. So as long as everything clicks and it's a good game, I mean, I guess I could see, like I said, kind of shelling out the $50. Plus, I'd have to know I'd have people to play with. But it sounds like if you guys were getting it, and Zach will for sure have it, that it might be worth it.
Okay. So what happens when 9 months down the road, it's also a Wii U launch title for $50? 50 or 60. then what?
Game of the Year edition.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know. I almost feel like a game like this has a really high chance of being released on a home console down the road, or at least in some way that I could play it. Maybe on iPad. I don't know. I could output my iPad to a TV if I really wanted to. I don't want to play this game on a handheld. Like, I want a good game to play on a handheld, but Resident Evil isn't that game.
Right. I mean, we've talked about this before, and I mean, you even kind of mentioned it a little earlier now, but just that, I don't know, Nintendo's in this weird phase where they're bringing odd games to their handheld. You know, it's the complete opposite philosophy than the DS.
You know, when they launched the Wii and they didn't, you know, jack up the hardware to match the competitors, I think the idea was people don't need great visuals to have a really good gaming experience. And then they put Wii Sports in the box to sort of drive their point home. They bucked general convention with their new system when they put out the Wii, and it paid off for them. And I think with the 3DS, they've almost played it too safe. They've just done the most obvious thing, which is make the system more powerful. And yeah, they threw the 3D screen on, but I don't think the 3D screen has convinced anybody that it's anything more than just a cool gimmick.
Oh, like, no, not at all.
So,
not
at all. So at the core of it, the 3DS is nothing more than a more powerful 3DS. So they've basically done the exact same thing with a DS that, say, Microsoft did with the Xbox 360 and Sony did with the PS3. And now I think they're having the same kinds of problems that Sony and Microsoft had right out of the gate. It's too expensive for the people who are saying, you know, I was kind of happy with the old one, honestly.
Yeah.
Their core audience, I mean, maybe not the core audience, their broad audience. The core audience bought the thing. That's why we're talking about it. That's because you and me, the three of us already have one.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm excited to see how they sell this Christmas. I would especially be excited
too,
to see how Resident Evil might have sold this Christmas. Because, I mean, can a game at $50 in a handheld? I mean, there's been some PSP games for 50, hasn't there?
I don't know.
Didn't PSP games sell at 40 at full MSRP?
I'm pretty sure you're right.
And then there was a handful of them that maybe went higher than that, I think.
You could be right.
Yeah, probably. Maybe some of the quirky, like, smaller, like, I don't know, Japanese games.
Maybe. I was thinking maybe like Madden was selling for 45 or 50 on PSP, but been a long time since I was.
Oh no, I don't think Madden ever was, but some of those, I wouldn't be surprised if some of those like Square Enix games sold for 50.
Right.
Got to get the Square tax in there.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding.
Birth by Sleep or whatever the fuck it's called.
Well, that's the only piece of news we got. Resident Evil Revelations is coming in February for $50 with no slide pad. And it has online co-op, and by all accounts, is going to be a pretty great game for a pretty premium price.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess if anyone in the comments on this episode, kind of let us know. I mean, are you going to pay $50 for it? Is that too much? Is that reasonable? I mean, what do you think? Be interested to kind of hear the response.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's...
I would rather...
I probably would not buy it at $50, honestly. Even though I love Resident Evil, I'd try to find it cheaper somewhere else.
I'd rather I'd rather spend $20 on an RE4 port to 3DS. Because honestly, like, I don't really care if I'm playing the new one or the old one. I haven't played the old one in 4 years. I might as well play it again.
Yeah.
I was thinking about when everyone was talking about Arkham City and how awesome it was and how it was like just the best game ever, but it wasn't necessarily that different from the last one. Honestly, all I really wanted to do was find a copy of Arkham Asylum for $10 or $15 and play that again.
Dude, Arkham City is amazing.
It's really good.
Yeah, but is it amazing in different ways than the first one was? Or is it just more of the same that it's just so awesome it doesn't matter?
I don't know. To me, the whole...
I think it's a very different game.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Because
I mean, just traveling the city.
Just doing the city stuff, but... It only becomes Arkham Asylum-y when you're going in a building and doing something.
Mm-hmm. See, I kind of felt like Arkham Asylum was already kind of a small city. There was a lot of different buildings and, like, a very distinct overworld. And I mean, it was...
Yeah, but this overworld is like Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Like, there are a million things to do.
Yeah.
And once you get enough equipment, you can basically traverse it like Spider-Man in Spider-Man 2. Where yeah. You're just, like, web-slinging
that
from
is
building
pretty
to
slick.
Building.
That is definitely pretty yeah. slick.
That's really nice.
Well, yeah, that's all we got.
So there you go. If you had to choose between them, Andy, I'd actually go with Batman.
Between over what, Resident Evil?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
My question right now is if I do come across $60 to buy a new HD game, do I get Uncharted or do I get Batman? Because I really loved Uncharted 2 a lot.
No,
I would say I liked Uncharted 2 more than Arkham Asylum.
Really?
Yeah. If you're going for, like, bang for your buck, like this is the only $60 I'm going to have to spend for the next however many months, I would lean towards Batman just because I feel like there's more content, it's more yeah. open, and there's more to do. But
and besides that, do you, Andy, did you play any of the multiplayer for Uncharted 2?
Nope.
Well, then don't get Uncharted 3. I mean, for your $60, go with freaking Batman, because that'll last you months.
Right, I'd say rent Uncharted 3 and just beat the campaign, and then...
Yeah, that's probably a good idea, and probably what I will, in fact, do. But to be perfectly honest, the chances of me getting the opportunity to play either game before, say, June of next year is looking slimmer by the day. Well, here's hoping.
You get the Game of the Year bundle.
Yeah, exactly. I'll just play Arkham City on Wii U.
There you go.
Yeah.
It will be a launch game.
It will be a launch game, like most of this year's best titles. Okay, that's all we got. Let's move it along. Nothing to see here. Zach Miller, and Zach's just recently put some time into Cave Story 3D, the new hotness PC remake on 3DS. this is what, the fourth platform this game's been on? PC,
yeah.
WiiWare, well, DSiWare, and
PC, DSiWare,
yeah.
WiiWare. It's also on Mac.
Oh, yeah, Mac, sure.
I think it's on, like, Amiga. Somebody did it on Amiga.
Is it on Xbox or PSN?
It is not.
It's not. Exclusive, baby.
Yep, I think it might be on the PSP, but don't quote me on that.
I will not quote you on that, sir.
Good.
So Cave Story 3D, this is the remake that they completely redid all of the sprite work and turned it into polygonal graphics with, of course, the 3D layer on top and
right.
all new music too, right?
Well, it's re-recorded by the Super Meat Boy guy.
Oh.
So in theory, it should kick ass.
Like Super Meat Boy.
Like Super Meat Boy music did.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't.
That's too bad.
It really sounds like... Okay, I guess I'll talk about the music first. The music is a huge integral part of Cave Story in my mind. The music is amazing in Cave Story. Very
I would
iconic,
agree. I would agree,
simplistic.
Yeah.
You would or would not?
I would agree, yeah.
Yeah. And
it's great.
The problem with Cave Story 3D is it's so orchestrated that it loses a lot of the charm. And
orchestrated,
synth orchestra, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. And some tunes are like, you hear the melody, you hear the original melody in there, but it's drowned out by lots of layers of other instruments. So that really disappointed me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, you know, and there's no way to turn on the original music. Like in the WiiWare version, you could turn on like the original game. Like the original,
sure.
original graphics and music, but you can't in this game.
There was a lot of people who actually really preferred the music of the free PC game to the version of the Wii remake, and that was great for them because it was included with the game, so they didn't actually have to choose.
Right.
So it's kind of nice. I mean, they already kind of chose by spending $10 on a game that would have otherwise been free. Or $12? I forget. How much was that game?
I think it was $12. But it was also, they had new content. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
You know. And that is the one thing about this Cave Story 3D that bugs me. It looks really nice, by the way. Like the 3D, I mean, not 3D, but just the polygonal graphics look wonderful. If I had one complaint, it's that everything's too dark. And when I say dark, I mean the color palette, but also the lighting. So if you're not in the right lighting conditions, it's a little like playing on the original Game Boy Advance.
Ooh.
You don't always know what you're looking at.
The game does take place in a cave.
It does take place in a cave, yeah. But
you never feel like it on the original game because, I mean, the graphics are bright and colorful.
Right.
In the original Cave Story, I thought.
Oh yeah, they are. I just wish they'd brighten up the color palette a little bit, maybe. You know, do you remember going through the ruined egg corridor before the bad ending?
Yeah, sure.
Well, in the, you know, original game, there were spikes on the ceiling, but you could see them and get out of their way.
Right.
In this 3D remake, the spikes are black or gray. So you can't always see him, and then all of a sudden, quote, is dead because he got skewered by a giant spike. That happened to me like 12 times, and it was just infuriating because I couldn't see the spikes.
I actually found that particular segment awfully difficult in the original game. I don't know why. I think it's just because you have to go through this segment and then fight a boss in the middle of it, and if you get hit very much on the way to the boss, yeah. And it wasn't like it was super difficult, but I had to play through that a lot of times to get past it.
Yeah, and there's no save point between. That's
yeah,
the part
it's like a good 5 or 10 minute stretch between save points there with a boss in between.
Yeah,
which is not really that bad, but in a game that's sort of as small as Cave Story, you get used to there being a save point every minute, and
right.
5 minutes is suddenly a long way to go.
Well, last night I beat the game. I got the second of three possible endings. The good ending, I guess, not the great ending, but the good ending. And there's a boss rush where you fight Misery, that witch, mm-hmm. and then you fight the doctor, and then you fight the doctor's second form, and then you fight the doctor's third form, and he is along with him, you fight Misery and one of those giant rabbits. All okay. at once. With no save points in between. It's like Beautiful Joe.
No doubt. So, spoiler alert, by the way, I think. Well, on the ending of the game, I don't know.
I guess so.
It's an old it's game.
Just infuriating. I was ready to throw my DS across the room.
Well, did you ever beat? Did you ever beat the original version?
Not the good ending.
Okay.
No. I gave up somewhere along the line, and then my Wii broke, so I haven't had a chance to go back.
Yeah.
But that was infuriating. But you know what made it easier? You know how I finally beat it? I turned on Classic Mode, which is sort of new. If you want, you can, when you're loading up your save file, you can choose Classic Mode instead of Story Mode, which replaces all of the character art or the character polygons and item polygons with the WiiWare sprites.
But they're still running around the new background.
They're still running around a 3D environment.
That's weird.
It is weird, but it makes certain bosses and enemies very visible.
Okay.
So, like the big core boss who shoots sperm at you and you fight it with Curly Brace.
Yeah.
Towards the, end of the game. In the 3D remake, it's kind of a cloud. Like that bad guy in the stupid Fantastic Four 2 movie, Galactus. Okay. How they just kind of copped out and made him a big cloud. Well, he's a cloud in the 3D remake of Cave Story, and you can't see him. So when you replace him with the WiiWare sprite, which is big and green and obvious, it's so much easier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like I'd probably play that way too, at least after a while. It's kind of like how when I'm playing any 3DS game, I've been playing Ocarina of Time a lot again lately, and when I first pick it up, I always put it in 3D mode, and then almost inevitably after 15 to 20 minutes, I'll turn 3D mode off because it kind of gets difficult to see things after a while.
Yeah, that's
you lose the sweet spot, and you know you shift the position so that it's not quite as comfortable to hold directly in front of your face, and after a while, just for the sake of not having to worry about exactly how I'm holding it, I'll turn the 3D mode off to make it easier to play. And it kind of sounds like that's what you're doing too, in a different respect. I mean, you could play it the old way, but it just kind of makes a lot more sense to play it with the classic mode.
Yeah, way you can see, and then there's a question mark unlockable mode, and I strongly suspect that it is a time trial through the final hell level, which I don't even want to touch.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I never made it through the game either. I made it just past the bad ending.
Yeah.
But not much further than that. So I haven't ever experienced the end of the game.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've seen YouTube videos of that hell mode, and it doesn't look great.
No, it looks like torture.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the boss at the end, you know, there's like three or four forms for that guy, so screw it. But, and the thing that I read this online in a preview somewhere, they said there'd be a Prinny mode, where you can be a Prinny from the, those little exploding penguins. Oh, God, what are they from? Shin Megami Tensei, maybe.
Okay.
And I was kind of excited about that. I was like, oh, you get to wander around as a Prinny and shoot stuff. Well, it's just a hat. You get a Prinny hat.
Well, thank God.
I know, and it doesn't do anything for you.
This changes everything.
Now you want to buy the game. But I was kind of disappointed about that. That is a new area. There's a few new areas in the game, and that's one of them where you get the Prinny hat.
Is the 3D effect in the game worth talking about at all?
It's all right. And the reason it's all right is because there are foreground elements.
Sure.
Stuff between you and in the background. So, take it or leave it. It's as I imagine a Metroid side-scroller should look.
Right, right.
But if you turn the 3D off, it's not a big deal. You're not really missing out.
It controls largely the same. I mean, does it feel the same?
It does feel the same.
Okay.
Sometimes it's hard to tell where you can jump just because of the angles of the polygonal environment and and it's so goddamn dark. But there's a nice map on the lower screen that maps out every block of the area you're in, so you can kind of use that as a guide.
Cool.
Yeah. So, you know, the problem is, though, I mean, we were talking about the news about overpriced games. This is $40. And the WiiWare game is $12, and there's more content.
And the DSiWare game is $10.
Yeah.
And the other game is free.
It's free.
at a certain point, yeah, I mean, I suppose they feel, the publishers and developer feels, that the reconstruction of all of the sprites and backgrounds into completely new art assets warrants the price point. But, man, that's a hard sell on a game that people have already been playing for a long time now. I mean, Cave Story came out in what, 2009?
Eight.
Well, on WiiWare?
Oh, on WiiWare, yeah. Not, it might have been 2010.
I think it actually was 2010 because we did a game club on it.
Yep.
Early in the run of Newscast, which started in late 2009.
That might have been our first game club.
It was that or Mega Man, one of the two.
Oh yeah.
I don't really recall, but
we should do our own show.
We should probably one of these days. rest in peace, Newscast. no, I mean, that's a good point, though. Like, $40 seems like an awfully hard sell for this game, but I'm curious to try it. Like, it's one of those things where if they had a demo on the eShop, I'd probably download it and play it.
Yeah.
But the chances of me dropping $40 on this game, much like the chances of me dropping $40 on any game, it's pretty limited. Like,
oh, yeah.
If I'm spending $40 in a game, it better be something I haven't really seen before.
Yeah, like,
or at least, I mean, I guess I paid $40 for Eco and Shadow Collection, but that's because those are some of my all-time favorite games, and they at least have a new coat of polish.
You know how much I paid for that?
How much?
$25.
Yeah, that's because you were more patient than me. I went and bought it day of release at freaking GameStop. Dumbass.
Well, you know, we're going to have to talk about those games sometime.
Yes, we are. I agree. Let's let's do ourselves a little bonus segment on those one of these days.
Yeah, let's chill. Well, that's Cave Story 3D for you. If you like Cave Story, there's a WiiWare version that's got more content.
If you really want to play it on the DSi or the 3DS, I don't know. It's your choice. Either $10 for the old version or $40 for the new version.
Yep.
It's your call. But
how much do you need to see, quote, in 3D?
Yeah. And that's not a phrase that he's quoting. That's the name of the character, right?
Yep.
Did they actually name him in the game, or is that just like a background thing?
If you save Curly Brace and restore her memory, she tells you what your name is.
Okay.
So
I don't think I ever
maybe.
Did that. I don't think I ever did that.
I didn't either. I'm replaying it now, and I'm going to try and make all the right choices.
Good luck.
Thank you, Game Facts.
By Danny Bivens here, who's becoming somewhat of a regular on Connectivity. How you doing, Danny?
I'm doing just fine, man. How you doing?
Oh, not too bad. I feel kind of bad. Danny just got Super Mario 3D Land about 15, 20 minutes ago, and I had about enough time to open it up before I had him come on here to record. So.
You bastard!
So at any point, he sounds very distracted and can't think about what he's trying to say. I'd imagine he's probably playing.
Yeah, so if you hear Mario sounds too, that might be a key.
Yeah, so listeners, keep your ears open. But, I invited Danny here to talk about a feature I guess we've had kind of in the works for a while here. I think even since I joined the staff, I remember seeing kind of emails pop up every now and then, with you working on this. And that's your expansion port feature where you, explored all the variety of expansion ports that have been on the different Nintendo consoles leading from the NES or Famicom all the way up to the GameCube.
That's right.
There weren't any on the Wii, as far as I know. That's correct, right?
That's right. Unless, well, I mean, USB ports, but, you know.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Nothing, so, nothing proprietary.
So. Exactly. So I guess starting things off, I mean, what even kind of got you interested in exploring the expansion ports? Because they're there, but until I read the feature, I kind of forgotten it. You know, if you flip the system, any of the systems over, you see them, but yeah, you kind of forget about them.
Right, and I don't know, I have a thing for kind of old technology and stuff, and I think, you know, the expansion ports kind of harken back to, like, the day where, I mean, you know, before USB, they had to have these things if they wanted to have, you know, some kind of expansion to the hardware. And that's one of the things that got me interested, other than the fact that I love Nintendo, too. But I thought it was interesting how a lot of this stuff kind of made its way into future Nintendo hardware, you know, stuff. And I don't know, I always just found that kind of interesting. And, I mean, throughout the article, I mean, you could see, like, specific ideas that kind of get recycled in, like, later ideas, too, which I thought was fascinating. And then some of these ideas that just all of a sudden they just stopped doing them. Some for obvious reasons and some for reasons that are unbeknownst to me. But
sure. So I guess if you kind of know it off the top of your head, if even just starting things off, if you would kind of break down, I guess maybe the variety of ports that each system had, you know, maybe how many they had.
Right. So I guess starting out with the Famicom in Japan, there was one expansion port that was on the front of the console, and this thing was used by a lot of different peripherals and stuff like that. In terms of, like, add-ons, I mean, the big things were, you know, the Famicom Disk System, which I know a lot of people have heard about, and also something that's a little bit more rare and not known is Famicom Basic and Data Recorder. It was basically it was a keyboard that hooked up to it, and like, I believe, some kind of a cartridge, so you could basically write programs in BASIC on your Famicom.
And, wow.
Yeah, and then the data recorder was essentially just a tape recorder, but, you know, you could record the data on the cassette tape. So that was kind of interesting. You know, a lot of these ideas were even going to be implemented into the NES in America.
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo was kind of thinking, like, hey, we want to make this be kind of like an uber high-tech kind of console to draw in, like, a, you know, just a, I guess, like, a, I don't know, uber nerd kind of crowd or something.
Right. Yeah, families of programmers, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, and then they kind of, you know, for the States, they kind of rethink their strategy and kind of thought, hey, you know, I don't know if this is going to be so successful. So this kind of started focusing more on family-oriented things, maybe stuff or you know, targeted more at kids, teenagers, whatnot. Or
right.
Just gamers instead of just people that are, you know, instead of just making this be like a computer, it's kind of make it, kind of set it apart, I guess.
Right, yeah, not, because, I mean, and there were already other systems in the States that were trying to do that, like to try to be like, you know, half like computer, half video game system.
Exactly. So I don't think Nintendo, they just, like I said, they just wanted to kind of separate themselves from that. And, you know, in Japan, they tried this a lot of things. So, I mean, the Famicom Basic and the data recorder came out anyways. I believe there are actually three versions of it. And some of the things were pretty cool. I mean, you could basically, like I said, you could program your own stuff. And they had assets from all sorts of different Famicom games, like Donkey Kong. That's the main one I could remember off the top of my head. But just, like, a lot of different assets, so you could, I don't know, put together crazy stuff. And
so you could pull that in and use that, like, in whatever you program?
Yeah, apparently.
Wow.
So I thought that was pretty interesting. And also, too, on each of the versions, they had some kind of, like, demos showing, like, what you could make, essentially kind of like mini games. And I think on the last version they released, they had, like, a lot of mini games. I don't remember how many exactly, but, I mean, there were a ton. And you could kind of just see, like, you know, hey, it's the type of stuff that you could program on here. So that's kind of cool for people that were maybe interested in that type of thing, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know how much you researched that specifically, but did you find, like, any examples of, like, work people actually did, like, consumers who purchased it?
I did not, but I did find some interesting videos of people adapting the Famicom Basic keyboard so they could use it on the regular computer.
well, that's something, I guess.
I guess. Yeah, I really didn't see anything like that. I also tried to look, see if I could find any, like, sales numbers, something on it, and I couldn't find anything.
Right. Yeah, I can't imagine it did too well.
Yeah. I mean, some of the things that I tried to look, you know, I'm trying to look for stuff in Japanese, I'm trying to look for the stuff in English, and it's, man, sometimes it's just kind of hard to know where to start. I mean, you know, but that was part of the fun of it, too. So.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's a whole exploration, I guess. And, you know, you said that things from, you know, researching this feature reminded you of future sort of implementations, and mm-hmm. not so much the programming, but that even almost reminds me of something like maybe Mario Paint, mm-hmm. specifically, I guess, sort of like the sound composer, mm-hmm. you know, where it's this, like, tool that they just created, and you just kind of had, I don't know, like, you could just do anything with it, and even now, like, people still make medleys and put them on YouTube and stuff, you know, of, like, mm-hmm. popular songs put mm-hmm. together in Mario Paint, so it's just kind of, it's almost kind of that same ideology a little bit, you know, like allowing people to create something through their system.
Right, right. And I think another interesting thing about this particular piece of hardware, I mean, essentially the data recorder is kind of like a precursor to a memory card in a way.
That's true.
And some, actually, the data recorder was used outside of the Famicom Basic 2, was used in like some games. Let me think here which games. Maybe Excitebike, I think, actually used it in Japan.
Like to save like your creative
tracks? Yeah, to save the creative tracks. Wrecking Crew, I think, had some kind of saving things too. Hold on, I'm kind of checking it out. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, maybe not. but there were actually some games. Looks like a game called Castle Quest, Mach Rider, and Lode Runner, and then this Japanese game called Nuts and Milk. I don't know. Terrible name.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, but apparently these games use the data recorder. And I think for some of them, too, I remember reading about Mach Rider, that some of, I think in the NES versions, that there was, you could still see the option to save, like, this stuff, but it obviously couldn't because it just didn't have, you know, the means to do that, so.
Right.
Yeah, so that's kind of interesting.
Wow, okay, that's fascinating. Well, I'm going to call it now that I think the next 3D classic on the 3DS should be Nuts and Milk.
Yes.
But let's go ahead and move on then. Now, the NES had one expansion port on the bottom of the system.
That's right.
Which, actually, reading your feature, it turns out in later iterations of the system, they actually, like, covered it up with a plastic tab that you had to make manually break off to even get to.
Yeah.
I guess they kind of gave up on using it at any point.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think. I think my actual NES, you know, it's back in America, and I'm in Japan, so, you know, what can I do? But I think mine had that on there, and I remember looking at it, like, about 10 years ago, saying, what is this? And I remember, I think I just opened it up and looked, and was like, okay, great, some kind of weird port.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. It is some kind of just weird port on the bottom, but they were planning to make use of it. And a lot of this stuff was almost completed, not specifically from Nintendo, but like third party. And actually, Nolan Bushnell, the guy who's kind of with Atari, you know, that guy, Mr. Atari, basically, and a group of other guys, Nolan Bushnell came in a little bit later, they're working on a modem for the NES called the Teleplay modem. And one of the cool things about this modem is that, I mean, it's basically wanting to do, like, you know, head-to-head competitions for people, you know, across the country.
Right.
And one really interesting thing about this, too, is that they supported cross-platform compatibility. So, I mean, if there was a game on the Super Nintendo and a game on the Sega Genesis, or NES, I guess, rather, and actually they were working on a Genesis version of this, Super Nintendo version of this, too. But so if there was, like, some kind of cross-platform title, you can play with those, you know, apparently with those, you know, against each other, even if you have different consoles, which is something that you can't really even do now. I mean,
today, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I mean, it's progressive.
Yeah. So that's kind of awesome. Unfortunately, it never really got out the door. It just kept getting pushed back and pushed back. Yeah, and, you know, at one point, around the same time that this was happening in, like, the early 90s, you know, Sega had the Sega Channel in the United States, and, you know, and I think it was hard for this company because they're pretty small, and they were kind of trying to just get their foot in the door with this, and it was just really difficult for them to do it. I mean, I think Sega, they had partnerships like AT&T and stuff like that. And, you know, for this company, it was just really difficult to do. And
right.
Actually, kind of cool. Like, I found a really interesting, just a picture of like a, of, I guess like an advertisement from the time, like before this was launched. It's actually in the article. It kind of tells you about, you know, what this thing's all about.
Like an ad from like Game Informer or something?
Something like that. It's like, experience head-to-head competition without leaving your house. And it just goes into, you know, kind of the thing about it. But, yeah, the NES one though, I mean, it attached on the bottom of, you know, via the expansion board on the bottom of the system. From the picture at least, it didn't look like it ran all the way across the bottom. So, I don't know, this is a little extreme. If you could imagine like an upside down pyramid, it's kind of like that, but it's not like at a point. It's like, you know what I'm saying?
Right. So like that would make your system like uneven, like wobbly.
It looks like it'd probably stand okay, but I mean, I guess if you're, I don't know, having a fit and kick your console, it might fall over. I don't know. But, so that's kind of interesting. But, like I said, it didn't get out onto the market or anything. So, I mean, that's kind of disappointing, but, you know, whatever. But at the same time, too, Nintendo was actually working on something in the United States to basically allow NES owners to buy lotto tickets from their NES. But, I mean, ultimately didn't come out because, I mean, how can you check to see whether or not kids are actually playing this? And that was one of the big things. And they were actually testing this with the Minnesota State Lottery. And, like I said, then that kind of stuff kind of just hit the fan. And,
that's so bizarre. So it would have utilized a modem as well?
Yes.
To, like, electronically connect and then...
Yes, exactly. And that modem would have allegedly connected to the bottom of the console. And that's how they would have, you know, would have taken care of that. But,
yeah. That's probably the weirdest one I've heard yet.
yeah. So I thought that was pretty interesting, but unfortunately nothing really came of that either.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, probably. In Japan, on the other hand, I mean, all this stuff in America kind of happened in the early 90s, but in Japan in 1988, they actually released what they called the Famicom Network System. And basically this allowed Famicom owners to connect to like a Nintendo server via their home phone lines. Mm. And there's like a special cartridge that I believe it plugged into the top of the console, and then like another part of it plugged into the expansion port. And, you know, obviously you have to hook up to a phone cable to the thing too. And I mean, through this thing, you could do business transactions, stock trading. There's even game reviews, previews and stuff like that you can check out as well.
Incredible.
That's pretty awesome.
I mean, that's like more cutting edge than what they're doing now.
Exactly. And, you know, unfortunately, that's the kind of the trend I found with a lot of these pieces of hardware. It's like Nintendo took a lot of risks and they went like online, even though this isn't really online as we know it today, but they were kind of the front runners for this type of stuff. And that's kind of awesome. But then you ask yourself, what happened? Because, you know, you look at things like the GameCube and the Wii, and it's God. It's, you know, I'm glad that at least with the Wii and 3DS they're doing something, but it's like, man, they used to take, like, mega risks, and now it's just, I can understand, you know, you want to, like, lose money and stuff, but Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, some of this online functionality, from then, yeah, it would be very nice to have now. I mean, even, like, checking reviews and previews and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the Wii can do that a little bit now, like, in the Nintendo channel or whatever. But
yeah, and I guess
it took time.
Yeah, I guess you could go online with the Wii and, you know, check out stuff. But
Well, yeah, you could use the web browser.
As painful as that is. But
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, what really sucks, because, you know, with the Famicom Network System, you know, it launched back in the late 80s, and, you know, it was probably done, I think, by, you know, early 90s, mid-90s, whatnot. There's really no way to see what this thing was like unless I, you know, get a hold of some kind of magazines talking about this in Japanese.
Oh, well, that's true, yeah, because it's not like the network infrastructure anymore, so you can't even, like, log on and look
exactly.
at it.
Exactly, and unfortunately, I don't know anybody that actually used this thing. I don't remember specifics for hardware sales on this, but I don't think it was, you know, anywhere close to as successful as, like, something like the Famicom disk drive or something. So it's, you know, trying to find somebody that would have had this and played it and still remember stuff about it. And then to see if, you know, I could even talk to them, that's, you know, that's about impossible.
Right. But, you know, it's kind of interesting. Like it kind of brings to light sort of an issue with, I guess, the internet just in general. You know, it almost has like a prehistory phase where, you know, it was before people were really keeping track of these things and, like, mm-hmm. documenting things. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like an old, I don't know, like, piece of art that's been lost in time because no one thought to preserve it.
Yeah.
You know, or just make note of it in any way. Because you're
absolutely
right. Unless you found really old magazine scans, like, how would you even see what it looked like?
Exactly. And I haven't found those. So,
I think that'd be difficult.
Yeah.
Wow.
So. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was awesome. And, like I said, it's just a pity that we can't see what it actually looked like. But, you know, what are you going to do? So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I guess what were some other, I guess either from the Super Nintendo then or the GameCube, what were some other maybe intended use of those ports that you kind of researched and enjoyed finding out about?
Well, one thing I found, I don't know if this was intended from the beginning, I kind of highly doubt it. On the Super Nintendo, there was this add-on called Exertainment. And that's kind of a take on, you know, exercise and entertainment kind of rolled into one. Ha-ha. But, I mean, this is kind of almost like Wii Fit-ish before Wii was even the twinkle in Miyamoto's eye.
Right.
So, basically what this thing is, it's an exercise bike that hooked up to the expansion port on the bottom of the Super Nintendo, and you can keep track of, you know, basically what you do on an exercise bike, riding around and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the things that kept track of was, like, you know, the time, obviously, how far you've ridden, calories that you burned, and then your speed. And also, you can connect to, like, some kind of cable satellite or antenna and, I don't know, see some kind of, like, picture-in-picture type of thing, maybe TV or something. There's, like, you can see this in the article. It's a monstrosity. and complete with the, you know, hottie from the 90s with the crazy exercise gear, the swimwear over the
tights.
Yeah, I don't know how that style caught on, but hey. Anyways, kind of like the controllers were these weird little things that were kind of around the handles, and that's how, because there were actually two pieces of software that were released for this. One called Exertainment Mountain Bike Rally, and then like a speed racer game. They also later released them as like a combo, like cartridge too. But with this, I mean, there were the buttons and stuff like that were kind of laid out on the some little things that can attach to the handles, and that's how you would kind of control and whatnot. The thing about this piece of hardware, though, is that it was freaking expensive. The bike itself usually ran about $3,500.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and this was back in, like, you know, the mid-90s, like, I think 93, 94, something like that. So, I mean, if I was a kid and would have seen this, this would have been awesome. But there would have been no way in hell my mom would have got this for me. And there would have been no way in hell I would have been able to save up my allowance for enough. You know, for this thing, I'd still be saving now. You know.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, maybe. Did you say, was this released in the States or just in Japan?
In the United States.
It was in the States. Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I don't think this was released in Japan at all. I think this was
I
think this was an America only kind of thing. Because
was it licensed by Nintendo? Like, is it like?
I believe so.
Wow.
The company, they're still around that made this thing. They do, I mean, they do exercise equipment and stuff, so, I mean, it's like a legit, you know, exercise company. They're called Life Fitness is what they're called. And, but yeah, I tried looking for one of these things on, like, eBay and whatnot.
Did you find one?
No, I didn't. I did find some pictures of somebody who did have one, though, and it was looked like a yellowing piece of garbage.
Was it made of the same plastic as the Super Nintendo?
It kind of looked like it, but, yeah, I mean, his, the one that they had in the picture, they didn't have, like, the TV monitor and stuff. It was just, like, the mic. And in the picture, you can see, like, all these, like, the, like, this plastic cover over, like, the wheel and stuff. And I don't think that was on this particular guy's one. So, you know, I don't know how much luck collectors can have trying to find one of these things, because I just don't know if they're around. And, you know, if I'd have to pay like a couple thousand bucks for this, I think I could find better places to spend my couple thousand bucks.
I would think so. Yeah, I wonder for how much something like that would even go for now.
Yeah.
Well, that's incredible. That's probably my favorite one now.
Yeah. And, you know, with these games, you can actually play them without it, without the bike. So, I don't know. I never really heard of these games until I actually started researching this.
Right.
This feature. So.
Wow. Well, not bad.
Yeah.
Well, we've discussed plenty here already. I mean, is there anything else that jumps to mind? I mean, are these some of the more extreme uses of these expansion ports?
One thing that I absolutely love is the Nintendo 64 disk drive. And I know some people dog it, and it, you know, it never released inside of the United States, outside of Japan and the United States or Europe or anything, but I always thought this thing was interesting. And when they started developing the N64, this was basically thought of as like a set for the N64. Mm-hmm. This was always going to be a part of it, but they just kept pushing it back and pushing it back and pushing it back. You know, initially they thought that the cartridge size is like Mario 64 is like 8 megabytes, and they're like, oh my god, you know, we can't get these cartridges any bigger, so we have to have this disk drive. We have to have this, you know, to expand, you know, if we want to.
Right.
And so, I mean, the disk drive, it came out in like 1999 in Japan. There were actually like two different ways that you could buy it. One via like a subscription service to do it. And you pay, like, you know, a certain price per month for, like, a year or for 2 years, and then the system, it's yours.
You leased it almost?
Kind of. It's, you know, in Japan, if you buy a cell phone, it's a little bit different than what you do in the States. In the States, things are, like, subsidized, so if you get an iPhone, you know, it's going to be, like, you know, $200, $300, whatever, and then you're locked into a two-year contract.
Right.
In Japan, I guess this is something that they used to do in the States. They don't really do so much now anymore. They do it so you basically pay for the hardware every month. Like, you know, I bought an iPhone, I pay, you know, like 2,000 yen a month, and, you know, for 2 years, and that equals the amount that the iPhone would be basically without a contract, you know,
right.
The real price for it, not like a subsidized price.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess this is kind of like the same thing. You could, I guess, pay everything up front and get the 64DD.
I mean, was it especially expensive? I mean, do you know roughly how much it was?
I believe it was something like 30,000 yen, 3,940,000 40,000, something. At the time, would have been like a little under like $300, maybe, I don't
okay.
know, 280, something like that. But
okay.
With the yearly plan, I couldn't find prices on like just a standalone unit. I only found prices for like the subscription stuff, so I'm not quite sure. But, the cool thing about these yearly plans is that you would actually get software shipped to you every couple of months, which was kind of cool. I mean, there weren't really a whole lot of games, you know, on this system. Let's see, I think just a handful of games, like less than 10. And that's like including a disc that basically lets you access. It's kind of similar to the Famicom network system where you could access like previous reviews and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And also, actually, I guess some kind of message board system and stuff. So that's kind of interesting.
Oh, wow. They actually let you communicate with strangers?
Yeah. Believe that. Yeah, that's crazy.
Again,
right?
Very, very forgotten philosophy, I guess.
But, I mean, you know, there's some really cool games that came out. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Scott. There's a game called Doshin the Giant. And there are actually two of them that came out on the 64DD. One of them was actually remade later and ported to the GameCube in Europe. And also in Japan, too. I believe in Japan. It's kind of like this weird game. You're this big yellow giant, and you're kind of like a god. And you're basically trying to, like, make people happy. It's weird.
Okay.
And then they have, you know, Mario Artist games. So, I mean, a paint studio, a talent studio, a communication kit and then a Polygon Studio with, you know, with some of the stuff, the Polygon Studio, you can actually make stuff in 3D. And, there's actually like a cartridge that actually plugged into the top of the 64.2 that you can actually hook up like a digital camera to and like pay, essentially what you'd be able to do after that is paste your face onto stuff or paste whatever that people take pictures of. But that was kind of cool.
Yeah, you know. I know where you're going now. Yeah. It took me a second.
Yeah. Probably the coolest piece of software that actually came up for it, though, was the F-Zero-X expansion kit. And if you had F-Zero-X on the N64, the cartridge, and this kit allowed you to create your own tracks and also create your own cars, too, which was kind of awesome. You know, I have both of them. I have the 64DD one. And I have the expansion, or the regular cartridge too. My only problem is, I just don't have the 64DD.
I was just gonna ask if you have it, and you don't have one?
It's so damn expensive. And, is it? I remember hearing Billy Berkheimer talk about this with, I think, James Charlton, when he was talking to him during, E3, or, Space, or, my god, Tokyo Game Show, thank you.
Sure.
And, actually, I think he is talking about how he had bought one here in Japan when he was here on like a trip like a couple of years ago, and I was here at the same time, and I know exactly which store he bought it from because I always saw it when I went in there. And I was just thinking, because at one point it was like, you know, it was something like $500. It was like the console and I think majority of the games. So that was cool. But at the time I just didn't have that much money just to throw away on something this awesome. But
right.
He bought it and I came back like a few months afterwards and saw it was gone and I just wanted to kill myself. And I don't know, they're kind of hard to find. You could find them on like Yahoo Auctions Japan and stuff like that. But I mean, they're usually like $500, $600, $700, $800.
Right.
So it's pretty damn expensive. But
yeah.
Like I said, some of the cool things about this though, I mean, this was supposed to kind of expand the N64 to kind of try to essentially kind of make it compete, I guess, lure developers into thinking like, hey, you know, this cartridge thing isn't as restrictive as it seems because you can make this stuff on the disc.
Right.
But apparently...
Yeah, my only familiarity with it growing up here in America was seeing pictures of it in Nintendo Power, specifically showing Mother 3.
Yeah.
Which we just talked about last week, actually, on last week's show. But yeah, how that was initially developed for the 64DD, and it was like, all I could do was just to wait for that, just pray for that to come to America. And then, of course, it never did. And the game, well, you know, was eventually canceled for that and eventually came out on the GBA and whatnot. But
yeah, because I remember seeing that too. Like a lot of really cool games got canceled. I mean, yeah, like in Mother 3, I guess there's a Fire Emblem game that was being developed. You know, then some things just got moved around, like Ogre Battle, Paper Mario, Majora's Mask. And then some things just kind of got, like, I don't know if you heard of the game Animal Leader. It's in the U.S. It's called Cubivore, and Atlus released it.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
That's, I don't know. You know, honestly, it's pretty bad. I rented it back in the day on the GameCube, and it was kind of awful. But the idea was kind of cool. But anyways, that was originally an N64DD project. Like I said, one of the things they were trying to do is allegedly, this is supposed to encourage developers to kind of come in and be like, hey, you know, this would be kind of awesome to do. It would cut our costs and stuff like that. But, I mean, this was received pretty poorly by the development community. And even though some developers, like in the States, had interest in developing for the platform, Nintendo really didn't actively push for the development, which is kind of interesting. It's like kind of like they're, you know, building their own coffin and then just putting nails in it too, you know, it's kind of dumb. But, I mean, you know, as time went on, the kind of need for the disc drive kind of, you know, waned as the cartridge sizes got bigger.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, irrelevant by the time, even by the time it came out in 1999, it's irrelevant. And, unfortunately, the RandNet system that was online, their online system, it was only around for like a couple of years before it just got discontinued, which is, that's kind of crazy because then a generation before Nintendo with the Satellaview, it's like a satellite add-on type of thing for the Super Nintendo, that like their online system, if you will, satellite system was running for like 5 years. I think it ran until like 2001 and the N64DD thing ran until like 2001. So that's, you know, that's freaking crazy.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, so.
Well, that's wild. Well, yeah, so yeah, I would encourage everyone listening to, if you're interested in this at all, which I hope you are, to go and track down Danny's feature. If it's not on the front page anymore, which maybe it's been bumped down by now, but just go to features and read it. Cause I mean, I've been reading part of it, and then even just hearing this conversation, I mean, it's just, I don't know, wildly fascinating. All the sort of ideas they had for these expansion ports that never really fleshed out or just never lived up to their potential.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting seeing how with the Wii, they kind of finally, you know, went away from those. And they have the USB ports, I guess, if they ever wanted to do anything. But,
right.
You know, they got away from these expansion ports. So, and I know there's more uses for them that we didn't cover here. So I'd encourage people to read those. And, yeah, and thanks a lot, Danny, for stopping by. And you can get back to Super Mario 3D Land now.
Thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks. Well, this is Scott Thompson here, and I'm joined by Neil Ronahan and Pedro Hernandez, and
hi,
hello,
and Kirby, and we're going to be talking about Kirby's Return to Dreamland, which just released for the Wii, about a week or two ago now, and yeah, we've got some dissenting opinions here, and Neil and Pedro sort of take opposite views on this game.
I wouldn't really say opposite.
What would you say? Dissenting?
Yeah, dissenting might be the better term, because I kind of burned through this game. We got the review copy in kind of early, so before I sent it up to Pedro, I kind of made it my business, because I was like, well, you know, it's a new Kirby game. I'm very excited. And I played through it very quickly, which might be part of the reason why my overall feeling is kind of negative, but it was just kind of like I felt like it was going through the motions. It never really felt that inventive. Like, the coolest thing about it were the super abilities, which the novelty for those kind of wore off after you used each thing once. Mm-hmm. It really reminded me of, like, the giant mega mushrooms in New Super Mario Brothers, where, like, when you first see it, you're like, oh my god, this is the coolest thing ever. And then you realize that it's just a canned, like a predetermined path that you take when you get that in a predetermined section to do predetermined things. And...
yeah, that's probably true. I it was still more fun than the giant mushroom, which at points is useless if you did get it at the wrong time.
Yep.
And they did incorporate it into at least one boss fight. I haven't beaten the game entirely, but I know it was in one boss fight, where then you get it and you have to use it. But I don't know, I they're kind of fun. And then, you know, that they unlock like, secret, I guess, little subworlds where you go and then you get more gears, gears you collect in every level.
The 120 stars, I mean, energy spheres.
Exactly.
I mean, I like that about it. I mean, it reminded me of the, I forget what they're called in Kirby, the crystal shards in Kirby 64.
Yeah.
Except for, I mean, I guess in that case, I felt more compelled to collect all the crystal shards. Because then you unlocked, like, you know, like the final world of that. I didn't quite get to that point. I don't really know what collecting all the crystal shards does. Pedro, do you know that?
You mean on Kirby 64?
Well, no. Not the crystal shards. I mean the energy spheres.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Whatever the hell they are.
Well, they unlocked two other mini-games, the Ninja Dojo one and the Super Scroll.
Well, I mean, like, when you get all of them.
I'm not sure, because all of they say is that that you unlock the challenge levels, the mini games, and that's pretty much it. They don't say anything else.
I mean, the challenge levels I thought were very cool, and I thought that's kind of where the game shined. But just, I mean, like, I feel so weird in saying that, like, it's a Kirby game and I was disappointed, where, like, what else did I expect? But well, I mean, I guess it just felt like whereas like with Kirby Superstar, like there was a lot of variety in each of those games. Like I right. mean, it's the same basic mechanics, but each game is you know different enough that you feel like it's new. Whereas this one, it's just a lot of the same play style. And yeah, the game looked pretty and everything, but it just I don't know. Like
well, that's true, and I mean, I think that's worth mentioning. I mean, you saying you're not surprised that it's a regular Kirby game, but in a way, it is kind of surprising. I mean, when was the last time we had a traditional console Kirby game? I mean, it was Kirby 64.
Kirby 64, which I think holds up really well. And I mean, I was listening to get talked about on RFN recently, where I think that Kirby 64 is kind of a game that I think gets overlooked because I mean that added something new to the Kirby series with the dual powers and everything. But
right.
With Kirby's Return to Dreamland, it's like just the same thing.
That's something that I was going to mention just now. Even though I love the game, and you guys can read my review about it, but I mentioned in the review that it might not be new enough for many players, as I mentioned in one of the cons. And I have to agree that it's very straightforward. And that kind of surprised me too, but at the same time, I didn't play any of the latest Kirby games where I have to agree that they were very experimental. Like, you had Canvas Curse, which was a touch screen controlled platformer. Then you had Kirby Mass Attack, which was basically Kirby meets Pikmin. And then you had Kirby Air Ride and Kirby... I know
Kirby Air Ride is another game that, I mean, I won't say it's a great game, but everyone just kind of shits on that. Like, there are some pretty cool things in Kirby Air Ride.
I always wanted to play that game, but everybody kept telling me the same thing, that the game sucked, that it wasn't worth playing, but I always was curious about it. But anyway, we had many years of Kirby, but Kirby as an experimental character with games like right. I already mentioned, Canvas Curse, Epic Yarn, Mass Attack. So it comes to no surprise that some people are coming into Return to Dreamland and they're feeling kind of about it because it's a very straightforward. In fact, if you compare the game to stuff like New Super Mario Bros. Wii, Donkey Kong Country Returns, and Wario Land, those are games that are kind of like classic, but at the same time, they're trying to do something new with the gameplay. But Return to Dreamland is very straightforward and to the point, keeping all of the gimmicks to a bare minimum, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I also feel like if Kirby's Return to Dreamland came out before New Super Mario Bros. Wii, the whole four-player mechanic would seem a lot fresher.
Definitely.
Well, you can go ahead.
But I mean, like with New Super Mario Bros. Wii, like really the hook with that, I mean, outside of it being you know a new Mario platformer, which in all honesty it was kind of the same thing as Kirby's Return to Dreamland, except for in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, you actually kind of got you know, new suits that did more than, you know, give Kirby a whip, which Cowboy Kirby is probably my favorite new thing ever.
Yeah.
Because it's very cute. It's like how there's the Skylanders character that has two pistols and you can give him a cowboy hat. It just works so well.
Everything works.
But, like, I mean, and some of the new powers, like the leaf power, which I think is another new one. I'm pretty sure.
It's a new one. I believe it's a new one, yeah.
Yeah, the leaf power is stupid, but that whip Kirby or Cowboy Kirby or whatever.
The spear is new, isn't it?
Yeah, spear is new, and that's basically what Waddle Dee, one of the four-player characters.
The spear is my favorite. I love the spear. But I was gonna say, I think playing the game co-op is what makes it worth it for me. And did either of you play much of it co-op?
I didn't like. I played it for a little bit. I didn't coax Lauren into playing it with me, despite like she actually likes Kirby games. So I don't know. It was probably because I was just like, I need to beat this right now so I can send it to Pedro. So she was like, yeah, screw this. But I did get a friend of mine to play it with me for a little while, and I also played it at a press event a couple weeks ago where I played a level co-op. And I have to say, the cruelness of everyone being Kirby and being able to steal each other's powers is wonderful.
Yeah,
but. I mean, it does kind of suck that, like, you know, other people can be Meta Knight or Waddle Dee or King Dedede, but you really, it's just like, it's like those are just different powers that you can play as.
Well, I mean, that's kind of some of the strategy where it's like, well, the second player has the choice where he can play as Kirby, but then he can lose his power, or he can play as one of these characters that basically have one of each of like the three best powers in the game. I mean,
yeah,
because
you got sword, hammer, and spear.
Yeah.
Did you play a lot of it with co-op, Scott?
I'm playing exclusively with co-op.
Oh, okay.
Me and my fiance are playing through the entire game. I haven't played any single player, and I feel like that's probably why I have an entire, not entire.
I mean, I would definitely say that's probably why I'm a little negative.
Then that's
about
what I was
it.
Thinking. I think that's why I'm much more high on the game, and which is why I would say if you do have someone like that to play with, especially, you know, a girlfriend or a family member who, you know, will enjoy this with you, I think it's a great game right up there with Donkey Kong or with Mario. And probably even a little bit better than Epic Yarn because it's more challenging.
I did play co-op Epic Yarn with a friend of mine and Lauren, and that does not work that well because you come over here, ah crap, all right, I have to go back here, and then you jump there, all right, let's go, oh yeah, we can't die, so if you get stuck there, I just gotta wait for you to come out.
Exactly. It was fun.
And speaking of multiplayer, now that we entered into that realm of the discussion, I think that, in my opinion at least, Return to Dreamland has a slightly better multiplayer than New Super Mario Bros. Wii because of the straightforward design. And what I mean by that is that Mario is more action-oriented. So when you had four players on screen at once, everybody doing their own thing on a massive level, it got kind of confusing because one would die off and the camera would pan out and everybody would be, where am I, where am I? And somebody would die, appear on a bubble, and you have to go to the other player and try to pop the bubble out, etc. So on one hand, well, that made it fun. On the other hand, it made it kind of confusing and very silly and hard to play. Whereas in Return to Dreamland, I feel that the streamlined design of the Kirby franchise allows for a slightly better multiplayer experience. I am talking about preference here, but what I mean is that, for example, when one of the characters stays behind on the screen, instead of waiting for someone to go back to the other character and bring it back to the screen, the game actually picks up the character and brings it forward to the actual screen.
But can you ostensibly do that with the bubble in New Super Mario Bros. Wii?
Well,
you can, but then you have to get popped. You don't just,
yeah,
you can't
true.
Get out of the bubble. Plus, you slowly float over.
I mean, my
like,
thing is that, like,
I think
there's a sublime beauty to the multiplayer New Super Mario Bros. Wii, and that, like, you know, it becomes so competitive, and you almost need to compete to cooperate in that game. Which, I mean, like, I can't speak because I have played, you know, I think my first time I ever played New Super Mario Bros. Wii, that the final copy, was I sat down with two of my friends and we, like, got through four worlds, and it was incredible.
Yeah.
And I obviously don't have that same experience with Return to Dreamland. But, I mean, I don't know. There's something about, I mean, I have played multiplayer Kirby before. I played multiplayer with this. I've done it in past games. And I don't know. I would say that New Super Mario Bros. Wii is a better multiplayer experience than Kirby is, but...
And they're close. It's all a matter of preference, I suppose.
Like I said,
I don't think either is really bad. I think one is better than the other.
I think Donkey Kong's better than both, if I can be so bold.
I think the problem with Donkey Kong is that you both need to be very good at platformers in order to do it.
What was so great about that is, I mean, that was another
Diddy
game
Kong
I played.
Could just hop on the back.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that was another game I played entirely with my fiance, and I mean, it's not like she plays a lot of games. I mean, we basically just played these games together. And so it started off where we were both a little rough, but as we kept playing, because it was challenging, I mean, she actually grew as a player, I guess, and got better at it, and I enjoyed that rather than something like Epic Yarn where it was you couldn't die. So it was amazing by the end of it how good had gotten at it. But I agree.
I mean, I rocked probably two or three worlds. I never beat Donkey Kong Country Returns. I really need to go back and do that because that was kind of like the Nintendo game that fell by the wayside. I ended up picking it up like at I think a sale at Target like right after Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got through six worlds, and then I wound up, like, after putting it down for a while, my friend and I probably beat two or three worlds in co-op together, and that was excellent. It was just like, damn, that game's hard.
Oh, yeah, you got to invest some time in it.
Okay.
I'll probably write.
Now, it's my turn to be the discerning opinion of the suite.
Okay.
I hated Donkey Kong Country Returns. There, I said it.
Well, I hate you. No.
I hate it.
I love you, Pedro. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it.
Yeah. But I didn't... But, okay, hate is a harsh word. I would say dislike. Dislike because I started playing the game. I said, this is pretty cool. I really like it. Then I got to War 4 or 5. I don't remember which was the war that I stayed in. I started playing the levels. I kept dying. I put the controller down, turned the Wii off, never spoke of it again.
And I quit playing video games forever.
But in all fairness, I have to say that it might be the what I like to call the retro curse, because up to this point, retro has yet to win me over with their games. I didn't like Metroid Prime, I didn't like Metroid Prime 2, I didn't like Metroid Prime 3, and I didn't like Donkey Kong Country Returns, so I think they're cursed with me.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but I always kind of wanted to write something, and I probably will once the Wii U finally launches, but I think I'll always remember Wii as just this system that I played with my fiancé, and because of these first-party Nintendo games, because of Donkey Kong and Mario and then both Kirby games. I look forward to the fact that like every 6 to 9 months or something along those lines,
there's a new platformer with multiplayer.
Exactly. Another one of these like cooperative platformers comes along.
It's one of those things when people complain about how Nintendo keeps on like making platformers. It's like, go die in a fire. Like,
seriously.
I love it.
That, I agree.
Yeah, it's
like, I'd rather see this than like, do we just want to see them make shooters or something? Like, no.
Right.
I love platformers. I really like, if I were to make some kind of list of my favorite genres, it would be like platformers and then in a distant second, like Madden Wii Football. Like, and then like Super Nintendo RPGs. Like,
right. And see, what's so great is we're at a point where it's not very difficult to own the Wii along with another system. So it's like, it's not like you have to exclusively fight platformers.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like we're 15 years ago and that's all
that's
being made.
I would be pretty content if the only games I ever played were platformers.
You know, it's like there's so much out there that you can play. It's like you can play a platformer and then you can go play something else. You know, and it's not difficult. So I don't see any problem with it. And I could see if you're playing through everything alone by yourself, you know, they might begin to kind of blend together, but playing them cooperatively.
Yeah, I mean that's the trick. Is I need to trick Lauren into playing more games with me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean that's what like well the problem was is that we played New Super Mario Brothers Wii together and I would instinctually be on the defense and she'd be like, "Why did you throw me into the why did you throw me into that pit?" And I was just like, "I don't know. I thought you were someone else. I apologize."
That is the one pitfall about these games is absolutely, you know, not necessarily fights, but, you know, feelings can get hurt when you
I never got through the Scott Pilgrim.
And it was out the worst out of people.
I never got through the downloadable Scott Pilgrim game because I wanted to play co-op, and all it just evolved is to me and my friends kicking the crap out of each other, and we never beat the first level. I ended up like playing a couple levels by myself, but I was like, I really want to play this co-op, but we just can't get anywhere in it.
That was another game actually I played together.
It's just so much fun. It's just so much fun because you can bet your frustrations on some other guy. You're angry because the douchebag of the group. You're really angry, and you guys are
playing. The one friend who's just doing like a spin move with his character, knocking everyone down, be like, "Oh, I don't know, I'm just trying to hit the enemies." No, you're not.
And then everybody gets to pile up on the guys like, shut up.
Getting back to Kirby, I'm since I did play, you know, I basically played through the entire game, I'm likely not going to get it anytime soon, but I do look forward to a time when I can pick it up, and because I did get so close to beating it, I can go unlock the EX difficulty, which is like a harder mode, which would be kind of fun if they ramped up the challenge a little bit. I wouldn't say this game is a cakewalk. Like it does pick up in difficulty near the end, but it's still a Kirby game, so it's still kind of easy, but it's not like, you know, a total breeze. Like it's the kind of thing where if you don't got the right power with you, an area could be really tough. But if you got the right power with you, you could probably just blow through it.
Right. Exactly.
Which is, you know, that's like Kirby Design 101, if there is, right. If there is Kirby Design.
You can finish it, like, in a weekend. In a weekend, you can do it.
Probably, yeah. I've had it for about a week now, and we're, like, I think, we just put the ship together and went the first world after you put the ship together, so I don't know how much is left. Maybe probably not too much.
But... I think you got another world.
Okay, yeah. And then, yeah, and then we'll go back and find all the gears and do all the challenges and all that stuff. But, I
thought the minigames were kind of throwaway. I played them once each.
Yeah, I don't like the scope one too much, but the Ninja Star one is kind of fun.
Yeah.
I will say, I guess, for anyone, I saw in the comments of Pedro's review, someone was kind of like straddling between Mass Attack and this game, and I'll say that if you're going to play it alone, exclusively, I think Mass Attack is the better game.
Definitely.
It's different, and there's a lot of interesting things going on there, and I think that'll keep your attention. But if you have someone to play with, especially a close friend, like I said, a relative or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or something, I think Return to Dreamland is the way to go. Yeah. And I also wanted to see, did you guys notice like the sort of homage to Donkey Kong Country that's in Kirby's Return to Dreamland?
Not really. I
can't recall.
There's a level probably in the second or third world that's almost exclusively a level where you're like in the cannons that you
control. Oh yeah. I remember making the comment. I think I was playing that with a friend of mine. I was just like, "What are we playing, Donkey Kong Country?"
Right. And at one point, they even do like, I mean, it's pulled completely from Donkey Kong Country, where you're in a cannon and it looks like you're supposed to shoot up, but just at the bottom of the screen, you can see like the top of a barrel, and if you shoot down there, it automatically shoots you to the right. And you're just picking up bunches of bananas as you go. And it's like, it was totally Donkey Kong.
That's
pretty
awesome.
And then it took you to like a secret gear. So I was like, yes, I see what you're doing.
I see what you did there, Nintendo.
Yeah. I got you.
I mean, that's the thing, is it's made by HAL Labs, which, I mean, they don't do that much anymore. Like, they made Picross 3D, bless their souls. they actually worked on Mass Attack as well. But I feel like they've gone through a lot, because that's where... HAL Labs is actually where Iwata came from, and where Sakurai was. And once they left, they were kind of without a leader, so to speak. But I mean, they're still plugging away. They still make fun games. They made Vegas Dream back in the days, and Vegas Stakes, and Pedro.
Oh yeah, I love that game.
Yeah.
Even though I never gamble, I still love that game with all my heart.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, it's nice to see. You know, HAL Labs making Kirby games again. And they made two of them. And, I mean, I have my complaints with Kirby's Return to Dreamland. I still enjoyed it. I just, I guess maybe I'm in a nitpicky mood, maybe.
Yeah.
You'll hear more about that as I can divulge more of my experiences with Skyward Sword. And it's not that Skyward Sword is bad in any way, shape, or form, to tease a little bit. It's just that me and this game, we got a few issues, but it's still, I mean, it's still Zelda. It's still Kirby. They're still really solid games. It's just that because I'm used to this level of excellence, I, you know, pull it apart a little bit.
So you guys are like an old couple. You guys know that there's a lot of issues between you two, but you can't imagine you without the other.
That's pretty much just a good summary for my relationship with Nintendo on the whole. Like, I mean... I feel like we're going on so many damn tangents here, but screw it.
It's a podcast. It's a podcast.
Yeah.
It's about to happen.
But I mean, it is somewhat related to Kirby's Return to Dreamland in a way. But I always find myself, I mean, in any kind of discussion, as I'm sure anybody who's listened to Newscast and Connectivity, is that I'm usually that guy who's like, whatever, I don't care if iPod apps are really, or like iPad apps are really cheap. I just want to play games on my 3DS. I don't want to play them on an iPhone or something. Like, I am kind of that homer and like that Nintendo apologist. But the same thing, it's more like I feel like I'm sometimes like a battered wife with Nintendo. Not that they beat me, like physically, emotionally a little bit from time to time. but it is the kind of thing where it's like, I'm like, that they're going to make me happy. Oh, they released Kirby's Epic Yarn. They released Punch-Out. I love you. And then you're like, what? Really? You're releasing Golf on Game Boy for Virtual Console this week. Thanks a lot, guys. And it's what? It's $4? Are you kidding me? For Golf on Game Boy?
I gave you all of my money. I said, I gave you all my money, and that's all I get? A crappy NES game that could be bought for 99 cents as well?
But I mean, but at the end of the day, like, I mean, it's like the thing with Kirby, where, like, you know, I'm like, ah, come on, it's just a Kirby game, but I still enjoy it. And, yeah, I mean, Kirby's Return to Dream Land is a great game if you really like Kirby. If you're not really that into Kirby, I don't know why you'd be wanting to buy a game called Kirby.
Like, it's gorgeous too.
It is very pretty. I read some reviews that were like, oh, it was obviously like a GameCube game, and I think these were on some big outlets too. But the funny thing is it wasn't actually a GameCube game, which is something that I don't think it was when, I don't think the Iwata Asks came out then, but I think it was said earlier, and I mean, from looking at the game, like, that does not look like a GameCube game, right? I guess it looks like a Wii game, which kind of looks like a GameCube game. But, like, I mean, the development of the game is very interesting, because it started off where there was, you know, a four-player Kirby game on GameCube, and then that got canceled. And then they were going to have a 3D, like I guess almost like Mario 64-esque Kirby platformer game, like in 3D space, that was going to come out on GameCube, but that got scrapped. And then they had this kind of, like, this, like, pastel, like, you know, kind of like storybook Kirby game. And that also got scrapped on GameCube. And then it wasn't until, I believe, development on this game started in earnest in, like, October 2010, I think. I'm not 100% positive, but, like, this game is really, you know, it's been being worked on for a year. It's not actually 6 years old or however old you think it is. It's been a pretty new, I mean, obviously it takes into mind what happened before then, but this actual game, Kirby's Return to Dream Land, is, you know, it's spent a year or so in development.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it has been a very long time.
Nearly 10 years, actually.
And if you did get this game and you really enjoyed it, I totally recommend you go on the Virtual Console and get Kirby 64. I think that's a really good game. I picked it. I played it back when it came out. I never owned it. A friend of mine had it. And I picked it up shortly after it came out on Virtual Console and beat the hell out of the game and really, really dug it. I think it still holds up. I think it's unique for a Kirby game.
I never actually played it, so.
I mean, definitely, I don't think it's co-op at all, unfortunately, but if you like Kirby's Return to Dream Land, Scott, it's definitely worth checking out. Or just Kirby games in general.
I agree, and the game has a really neat mechanic with the power-ups where you can combine the two of them. Also, that was really inventive and creative. It's too bad that they didn't try to bring it back to another new game, because that was really
You can make Kirby look like Darth Maul. Like, he's got, like, I think it's lightning and sword, and you just get this, like, double-bladed sword. And of course, because it came out in, like, 2000, when I saw that as a kid, I'm just like, it's like Darth Maul! Even though, like, really, it's yellow, it's not even red.
But still, it matters. It counts. It still counts as a reference.
But sounds good. Well, I think that'll about do it on Kirby's Return to Dream Land. Like, even Neil, who came into it supposing to be the dissenting opinion, still kind of gave it a recommendation.
We won! We won!
Yep, we did it, Pedro.
There wasn't winning.
Yes, there was.
I was disappointed with the game. That doesn't mean I hated it. I was a little underwhelmed. It's still a good game. It's just not great.
Alright, and that'll do it for this week's episode of Connectivity. Before we get out of here, I'd like to remind you that you can always send us listener mail at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. Also, if you've got a spare moment, I'd like to ask if you could please rate and review us on iTunes. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.